From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling a film which is screening on the PBS series Independent Lens next week. It's called Terror. And if you see it spelled out, the title has the letter T in parentheses, and the word that's left is error, which really expresses what seems to be the absurdity of the story. The film is mostly about one FBI informant, a man named Saeed Torres, a former Black Panther and a Muslim who's down on his luck, and he's made a deal with the FBI to root out domestic terrorists. The film reveals the controversial tactics involved in using informants who are vulnerable to find other vulnerable people who might be considering terrorism. At the heart is this question of where you draw the boundary between stopping a crime and inciting one. Join us after the news. This week on Video West, meet Keith Gable from Ogden, who had a hard time imagining life without snowboarding. It's how he expresses himself, how he healed himself after a chaotic childhood. Filmmaker Skylar Nielsen and his team at Vita Brevis Films tell Keith's story in this documentary short about his terrible accident and the choice the doctor gave him: multiple surgeries and rehabilitation, or chop it off. Go to videowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're going to be profiling a film that is screening on the PBS series Independent Lens next week. The film is gripping, and it's personal and jaw-dropping at moments. It's called Terror, which in the title, the letter T is in parentheses, spelled out, which leaves you with the word error. And that's a good distillation of what some see in this story, that a lot of people are being arrested on terrorism charges in the wake of 9/11 based on information of FBI informants who have questionable skills and questionable motives. The film is really the profile, though, of an aging Black revolutionary who has been an FBI informant for years. And for complicated reasons, this informant allows the filmmakers, David Felix Sutcliffe and Lyric Cabral, to document a surveillance operation without the FBI's knowledge. And not only that, they also filmed the man the FBI was investigating. The FBI didn't know that either. In fact, neither the informant nor the target of this investigation knew the other was being filmed. It was last summer when we first spoke with David Felix Sutcliffe. He co-directed and produced Terror along with Lyric Cabral. I guess we need to begin with how all of this started. And really, it's a story. This is Lyric's story in many ways. She's the one that first encountered the FBI informant, who's the profile of the film, man by the name of Saeed Torres. Tell that story, how she knew him for years, this man.
Yeah. Lyric was in journalism school at Columbia, and while she was in school, she was living in a brownstone down the hill in Harlem. And at one point, a man moved in to the bottom apartment, and that man was Saeed Torres. And he was an older Black gentleman who listened to James Brown, and she would smell marijuana smoke wafting out while this music is coming out from the apartment. And she just thought, like, this man seems interesting. He's a person kind of trapped in time.
Yeah.
And so she started talking to him and finding out about his experiences at being a member of the Black Panther Party. And she, you know, she's a cultural historian. She is a strong believer in oral storytelling and would just, you know, spend a lot of time talking to him about those experiences. And this relationship developed over the course of the next 2 years or so. And then one day in 2005, she comes back to the apartment, back to the brownstone, and they had plans to hang out, I think, on a Saturday. And this was like a Thursday. Mm. And she knocks on the door and there's no answer. And then she goes and looks into the window, at the bottom garden window, and sees that the apartment is totally empty. It's totally vacant.
Right.
And she's baffled. What has happened to him? Where did he go? And at that point, she gets a phone call from him, and he sounds as if he has a gun to his head. That's how Lyric describes it. And he says, "Lyric, if anyone comes asking for me, don't tell them where I am." And she said, "Well, I don't know where you are. I don't know what's happening. What's going on?" He said, "I can't tell you right now, but like in a few months, you know, I'll contact you, and I'll tell you then." So I think a few months later, she gets a call from him, and he said, "Hey, I'm living in South Carolina, but I want you to come down and visit me, and I want you to write a book about me." So she went down and visited him and found out that he had been working for the FBI at that point for over a decade, probably about 15 years, since the early 90s, as an informant. And actually, the apartment in which they had been conversing was the safe house for an FBI investigation into a jazz bassist named Tariq Shah.
Right.
And Tariq Shah, Lyric had met him. You know, she had met him on a handful of occasions, and it apparently seemed as if, or not seemed as if, Saeed was actually engaged in trying to get Tariq Shah to participate in a terrorist plot, or, you know, ultimately Tariq Shah was accused of conspiring to provide material support to terrorism.
Right.
Merely because he read an oath by an FBI agent posing as a recruiter. You know, at that point, Saeed had offered him, you know, money and said, you can kind of get out of your child support issues. Tariq Shah owed a lot of money to the government. And so Saeed was involved in this investigation, somewhat entrapping Tariq Shah, trying to get him to kind of join this conspiracy. But when Saeed told this story to Lyric, she also realized that the apartment in which the investigation had been taking place was wired with audio and video surveillance, and that all of their conversations had, you know, potentially also been captured on tape. And she said, well, what did we talk about? Was he trying to engage me? And, you know, what conversations were, you know, that had sinister intentions, if any?
Well, and she said, Lyric, that she was really repulsed by all of that.
Yeah, I mean, informants are not people you go seeking out for friendship.
Yeah.
You know, especially, you know, within the black community, these people have, there's a history there that where informants have been used to destroy, you know, several social movements. COINTELPRO was, you know, really, had a devastating effect on the Black Panther. It destroyed the Black Panthers,
right.
You know, in the 60s. And so with that history in mind, yeah, she backed away. She said, you know, I'm not going to write a book about you, but I am a journalist, and I know this is a fascinating story and an important story potentially, but I think personally she felt really conflicted about that confession.
Yeah.
And so she said, you know, she stayed in touch with him for the next few years. She would call him every few months and just say, how are you and where are you? And also at that time when Saeed confessed to Lyric and I were both teaching at an after-school program in Harlem. We were both making videos, documentary films with high schoolers. And one of our students was arrested by the FBI, a 16-year-old Muslim girl named Adama Bash, who was arrested by the FBI in March 2005 and accused of being a potential suicide bomber. This was a month and a half before Tariq Shah was arrested, before Saeed disappeared. And so at that point, that was my first kind of introduction to this world, to this realm. And I began studying just what was taking place in these counterterrorism cases. And just to see the kind of far-reaching consequences of that accusation, that really is what kind of drew my attention and made me invested an interest in finding out more about cases like hers. And that's when I started to see in the vast majority of these cases, you know, that there, you know, I was attending several trials, informants were kind of the linchpin in these cases.
Yeah.
They would go into a community not to uncover terrorist networks, but really to kind of befriend young, angry, desperate men and try to convince them to participate in terrorist plots. You know, and that's, you know, to some extent that's an oversimplification, but that is the general model for these cases.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to the particulars as we go. The details are, I think, are important. I want to play a clip. And this is a moment when, for complicated reasons, Saeed agrees to let you film certain aspects to this current surveillance operation. He doesn't inform the FBI he's doing this, which is, seems really interesting because his relationship with the FBI is so complicated. We'll talk about that in a moment. But I want to play this clip. And this is a moment when Saeed is setting up his safe house in Pittsburgh. He's been asked to go there, check out some of the POIs, persons of interest. And what I like about this clip is a few things. For one is that it reveals his kind of prickly nature. Because throughout the film, he can be combative with you and with Lyric from time to time because we hear you off camera asking him various questions. And then you hear him resist being filmed because there are moments when he's not sure he wants to be doing this or he should be doing this. In this clip also, he'll talk about, as a Muslim himself, feeling no real sympathy for the people that the FBI have targeted. Let me play this and we'll talk about it. Again, from the film Terror.
What is the map on the wall?
Why is the what?
Why is the map on the wall?
Find my locations around here.
Is there significance to the red lines?
Yes. It's regarding the work I do. No, I'm going to give you the picture. I'm going to put them up on here. It'll be better for you because I don't want to explain nothing to you. You got it. That's it. Don't ask no question who they are. Giving you something that you shouldn't be seeing anyway. You know something? I know it's you always getting
headshots.
Didn't you say you wanted to do this project?
Man, don't you ever give it a break? Now I can see why them celebrities don't like Pazerazzi.
You're not gonna tell us anything?
No. I mean, these are all targets that's in suspected areas. For some reason, they got a big population of Muslims that come from the various countries over there to come to school here. Moroccans, Somalis, Iranians, Saudis. And then they all go back from where they come from. I don't have no feelings for them. You're making Islam look bad. You got to go.
Let me ask you about his... In many ways, David Felix Sutcliffe, would you agree that in some ways, while this is about a very important issue and a very controversial issue, in other ways, it's also just a kind of beautiful, sad portrait of a person? Would you agree with that? Do you see it in that way? That's how I saw it, at least.
Yeah, it's tragic. You know, it's not just sad, it's tragic to me. And that was important to us to kind of, I think, and that the lyrics relationship with him is such a critical part of this film.
It really
and
is.
Kind of expanded the portrait in a way that I don't think is common within documentary film. And it certainly would not have been the way that I would have approached it if it had just been me in that room with him. You know, going into this, I was approaching it from, you know, someone who had sat through numerous terrorism trials and had seen the kind of damage that informants under instruction from the FBI had caused to families and to communities.
Yeah.
And I think I had this animus that, you know, was informing my own approach. But I, fortunately, because of Lyric's relationship and her kind of desire to kind of capture the larger human story here and how this man was really kind of a victim of larger forces, he had made terrible choices. He had made terrible decisions. But at the same time, he had been manipulated by the system, you know, and kind of offered these incentives that no person in his position would be able to resist. Mm. And I think we wanted to capture that tragedy and also to kind of point the finger at the people who are kind of directing him, the FBI, the government.
Well, I found myself throughout the film really liking him at moments and just really hating him at moments too. And I'm wondering how you describe the way you feel about him, or at least felt about him, because he's you know, he's got this kind of prickly personality. He's confident, but then on one hand, he's also vulnerable. Wants to be a baker, you know, make custom cupcakes. He has these dreams, mm-hmm. and nothing's ever worked out for him. I mean, how do you describe your sense of, you know, your relationship with him?
Well, yeah, the process of filming this was very difficult for me. You know, I had made another film before, and that was about Adama Ba. That was about a young woman who is one of the most extraordinary, beautiful, strong people I know. And her family, they're all people I care about deeply, and I love them. And I loved spending time with them, as difficult as it was to watch them going through that experience. And so that had been the only experience I had making a film. And I think that's kind of typical for a lot of filmmakers, that you grow to kind of care about your subjects if you're spending years of your life with them. You know, it's hard to do that about someone who enrages you and angers you. And in many instances, you know, that's how I felt about Said. That's how I felt towards him. But at the same time, you know, there's qualities that, you know, that he can be incredibly charming. He can be incredibly charismatic and fun to spend time with, you know, and then you can kind of turn it off and you just want to get as far away from him as you can. But this is someone who's angry, and he's angry for a reason. And part of that anger is, you know, it's the consequence of self-inflicted, you know, wounds. And part of it is because, you know, he is someone who has, as I said before, like been taken advantage of. And, you know, I'm glad that the filming process is done. I will say that.
Yeah.
But I'm also glad that I think the response that we've gotten from the film, you know, I feel like we kind of captured that complexity.
Yeah.
You know, I think everyone's going to have their own responses, but I've heard it from enough people that there is that complication there. There is this kind of twisted engagement with who he is, this anger at him, this kind of sympathy for him that I think we accomplished something in that regard.
Yeah, I've never seen anything like it in that sense in a documentary film. And I think you're right that his relationship with Lyric, and then eventually also with you, because he sort of pushes back on you from time to time too, makes it really a unique experience. Let me play another moment, because this gets us to this question of these FBI informants. This is a crucial theme in the film, of course. And we have to understand that Saeed has a past, and he gets arrested, you know, which makes him desperate, and it makes him really vulnerable. And he tells in this clip about the experience of being arrested and then being approached by the FBI. Here it is from the film Terror.
Yeah, I was charged with grand larceny, impersonation of New York City transit cop, possession of weapons.
When were you first approached by the FBI?
Oh, I was approached, man, when I was arrested. So the guy said, okay, we tell you what. Here's our card. You need something, you let us know. Now, you want to make a deal? You facing 20 years right now as it is. And I said, damn, 20 years in the feds. So I said, I called him in. I said, yeah, what you want to speak on, man?
Does that express one of the things you're trying to get at in the film is that you've got these people who are making these, who are informants for the FBI, who themselves have conflicted motives, are in many cases, certainly in the case of Saeed, kind of desperate. They'll really do anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really a choice. You're looking at 20, 25 years in prison, and the FBI says, you know, we need information and we can get you out in 5 or 10. You know, that's a situation that I think most people would, you know, they would make the decision. I can't speak for most people, but yeah. I think it's at the very least it's a difficult decision to make. And also, to some extent, they're approaching him and saying, listen, we want information about social networks. You know, it's just information. And I think that's what a lot of people think informants do. They think informants give information. And initially, that was the case. This is before 9/11. Mm-hmm. Saeed was, you know, he was a member of a security team at a you know, one of the most well-attended mosques in Brooklyn. And they also said that there's people that we want to know more about who we think are connected to the World Trade Center bombing. And so he began telling them, you know, they said, we can get you out. And he said, okay, well, I'll tell you what you want to know. And so there was that information sharing that took place. And then after 9/11, when he had been released, you know, they knocked on his door a few days later and they said, listen, we need someone like you. You have the relationships. You have connections. We want you to kind of go after the bad guys. And I think at that point he said, I've done some things in my past that I'm not proud of. And maybe this is an opportunity to, you know, make – you know, to kind of heal those decisions,
yeah.
And also at the same time make a lot of money.
Right.
You know, that was also,
and he makes a lot of money. I mean, 150,000 or something per case.
At the height of his career, he was working on two cases simultaneously, and he said each of those cases was $250,000.
Wow!
And you know, the one case where he was investigating this man, this Yemeni sheikh, who was accused of being a financier to Osama bin Laden. It later turned out that the Osama bin Laden and the sheikh had, you know, given Osama bin Laden money 10, 15 years before 9/11. But after 9/11, he actually condemned what Osama bin Laden did, and the Osama bin Laden issued a fatwa against him.
Right.
You know, there was no connection between these two men, and yet the FBI presented this person to Saeed as, you know, this is someone that we need to take down because he is financing these atrocious, violent acts. And, you know, and a lot of times in these cases, you know, they tell you, Saeed says, they tell you what you need to know and you don't know anything else. And with the case of Tariq Shah, you know, I think there's this kind of questioning. I'm sure that it must have taken place. Like he's there, you know, Tariq Shah was this bassist and the FBI said, well, we want you to kind of, you know, become friends with him. Take bass lessons from him. Just spend, you know, like 2-3 times a week. They're hanging out together. They're spending several hours a day together just talking. And these are both like two black men from Harlem who grew up like in the same community, have the same values. And I think they developed a real friendship. But at the same time, the FBI is telling him like he is a violent person and we need to kind of find out how far he's willing to go. And that, again, there's this kind of need to know. We'll only tell you what you need to know. So maybe, you know, Saeed is justifying this saying that they know something that I don't. And I'm gonna trust them on this, or I'm gonna kind of smother whatever guilt or conflicted feelings I feel, and just proceed. Because the carrot, the financial carrot that is dangling there, is so large. You know, how can he has just come off a case where he's made $250,000, and he sees that opportunity again. You know, to kind of walk away from it,
right.
is you know, how does someone like him do that? These are people who have criminal history. Saeed is a very skilled criminal. He stole hundreds of thousands of dollars from the New York City metro system, from the transit system, you know, by impersonating transit officers. So he knows how to kind of hustle. He knows how to do this. And I think these are the kinds of people that the FBI is looking for. They're looking for skilled con men. They're looking for people who can deceive and manipulate, and they use them as buffers because they don't want to get their own hands dirty because they know what's taking place in these cases, and they say, you know, the ends justify the means.
But are they reliable? You know, I mean, one of the facts that you point out in the film is that since 9/11, more than 500 people have been charged with terrorism-related crimes, and nearly half of them are the result of these paid informants. Are they – I mean, this question comes up in the film a number of times. You get a sense that he's a good hustler, Saeed. But is he a good informant? Is he really – because, you know, he doesn't like the word informant. He fancies himself an agent almost, that he has these certain skills to be able to draw people out. And then you wonder, really, does he have any skills at all? Do any of these guys have any skills? Are they really, you know, valuable? As a source, as a resource, if that's what you're trying to do is stop domestic terrorism, are they really valuable?
Well, they're incredibly valuable to the FBI because they have managed to yield hundreds of terrorism convictions. So the FBI sees that this is a strategy that has paid off. And unfortunately, no one is questioning the actual details and the texture within these cases because hardly any of these defendants go to trial because there's a 96% federal conviction rate. And when you're a defendant looking at those odds, you say, I'm going to take the plea. And you see that no other case has won an entrapment defense. Even in the case of the Newburgh Four, these are four unemployed ex-cons who are being offered $250,000 to blow up, you know, to blow up a synagogue.
Yeah.
And even in that case, these men were not able to win an entrapment defense. And that's because of this clause, the predisposition clause. And the government argues, you know, if you are predisposed to commit a terrorist act, then we can offer you any incentives we like, you know, almost, you know, $250,000 and still kind of avoid losing this on an entrapment defense. You know, and predisposition is this kind of nebulous word that if you can say that someone read a book about, you know, a certain tenet of Islamic philosophy or watches certain videos on YouTube, then you then have a case to say this person is predisposed because they express these angry beliefs because they say, I do not like what America is doing to other Muslims in this country and to others, and I'm angry about what's happening. And the combination of like the books that you are reading, the videos that you are consuming, then therefore, you know, it's game on. Here we go, and there are no strings attached, and there's also almost no oversight over the actual relationships between FBI agents and these informants.
Yeah.
You know, there's guidelines have been issued, but no one is evaluating whether those guidelines are actually being followed, and that's what we want the film to kind of bring attention to this, and also to kind of create a dialogue because it is incredibly complex, and we don't want to oversimplify and say that there isn't a threat. There is a threat. But are these the tactics that we really want to be using to kind of to neutralize that threat? And also, are these tactics being used fairly across the board?
Right.
You know, a report came out last week that, you know, white extremists and anti-government fanatics have killed twice as many people as Muslim extremists since 9/11. And yet in James Comey, the FBI director's 2016 budget request, he mentions ISIS 16 times, 13 times. He mentions white extremists absolutely zero times. There's zero acknowledgement of the legitimate threats that exist within this country because they're not politically opportunist. They're not, you know, these. He knows that talking to an all-white Senate committee about stalking and entrapping other white people who are hunting black people is just not a smart strategic move on his part. And it's absent from the conversation. It's absent from the media. And it's absent from our own dialogues as a public.
That's David Felix Sutcliffe, along with the filmmaker Lyric Cabral. They co-directed the documentary film Terror. Next Tuesday night at 11 o'clock, Terror is going to air on KUED Channel 7. It's part of the series Independent Lens. For more details and rebroadcast times, you can just go to our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a brief break and be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling a film about the controversial tactics used by the U.S. government, particularly by the FBI, in the wake of 9/11. This is not just a talking head piece. The filmmakers followed one FBI informant, a man named Saeed Torres, and they shot the film during the process of an actual surveillance operation. And not only that, they also filmed the man the FBI was investigating. The FBI didn't know that either. The film is called Terror. It's screening next week as part of the PBS series Independent Lens. Last summer, we spoke with David Felix Sutcliffe, who co-directed the film. It's interesting. The irony is so thick in the story of Saeed Torres because he is deeply involved in the Black Panther movement. And there's a deeper history to this story today because another time when the FBI used paid informants to root out subversives in American City was that time when the Black Panthers were really emerging as this social force. And you talk about that in the film. You explore that in the film, this idea, as you mentioned before, this COINTELPRO tactic used by the FBI. Talk about this particular moment because this was a time when the FBI starting to get informants and getting them to infiltrate in organizations like the Black Panther Party.
Yeah, I think COINTELPRO, the set of tactics that were being used that during that time were actually much more diverse. I think the FBI has evolved and they've kind of perfected their strategy. I think at that time they were really using misinformation to kind of help this organization self-destruct, you know, sending messages from East Coast to West Coast saying, you know, this leader wants to kill this other leader. There's this power struggle. And, you know, what we saw happen there was that ultimately these people became increasingly disenfranchised and, fragmented, and that the movement fell apart. And at the time, you know, Saeed, he'd gone to Vietnam and he'd come back from Vietnam and he sees, you know, the fact that he has kind of put his own life on the line to protect this country, and yet he's coming back to a country that treats Black Americans with very little dignity or respect. And I think that's when he's 21 years old, 22 years old, and he starts kind of attending these meetings with the Black Panthers and is kind of very much enraptured in these ideas, you know, these ideas of not just self-defense, but just self-empowerment and what resources exist within this community that we can kind of become independent and end this kind of dependence on government to protect us and to feed us and to educate us, and let us take that upon ourselves to do it in such a way that we avoid these traps of a white supremacist government and a white supremacist political system. And it's kind of, you know, this story that exists within a continuum, and that was important for us to show.
Yeah.
That this is not the first time that it's happened. That, you know, and it's, you know, we don't want to equate what was happening at that time with the terrorist movement, but what is the equivalent here is that, you know, the Muslim community has, you know, the targets of these investigations exist at a very small end of the funnel, and meanwhile the wide end of the funnel is the other 2 million Muslim Americans who are doing absolutely nothing wrong to warrant this kind of attention, and yet all of them are kind of dragged into this net, and they become suspect and they become fearful of what they will say, and what they do will label them as potential targets. You know, I have a friend, a Muslim friend, who said he was at home at his mosque in Ohio a few months ago, and he heard these two young 10-year-old boys kind of talking behind him, and then they're playing, but then one of them points up at a sprinkler system in the ceiling and says, "Shh, they can hear us, they're listening." You know, and just the implications of that a 10-year-old child is kind of considering that his actions and his words are being monitored. To what end and to what purpose? You know, what will become of that child?
Yeah.
You know, who will that person become? And additionally, you know, there's been reports that attendance in mosque is declining. People are increasingly reluctant to openly practice their faith. You know, there's Muslim student associations around the country where there are signs on the wall that say, like, do not talk about politics. You know, how is a community going to be able to defend themselves if they can't even talk about the issue or talk about the attacks that are being leveled against them?
And the reason it's become so powerful in the film is the irony of the fact that Saeed Torres becomes an informant. Let me play another moment from the film. We'll hear some archival film footage back of the day when The FBI Director Hoover is talking about the Panthers as a really great threat. And then at the end of this clip, which I think is really critical here, you ask Saeed if he was an informant during the Panther days. Here's another moment from the film Terror.
FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover today asserted that of the black extremist groups, the Black Panthers represent the greatest internal threat to the nation.
This memo apparently went out to 37 agents. It ordered them to find informers in the black ghettos. It was a command, not a suggestion.
The documents describe things like COINTELPRO, the FBI's program to disrupt political extremists.
The FBI had the organization under surveillance. There had been efforts to get people inside our meetings.
Were you an informant during the Panther days?
No.
What did the party say about informants?
They kill them.
Man, he really bristled when you asked him that question. But he got the irony of the fact that he's also now informing, didn't he?
I think in order to do this work, you have to be able to kind of repress and just disconnect so completely that you do not see yourself the way that others do. You know, he cannot acknowledge what he's doing. He can say that I recognize that other people would say that or would see that and may accuse me of X, Y, and Z of being a traitor, but that's not who I am, and they're wrong. But the conversation stops there, and there's no dialogue because, you know, in order to kind of go down that path, you know, it threatens the dismantling of an entire set of like moral codes that I think he has constructed to justify what he does. I am protecting America. I am protecting Americans. What I'm doing is important. And that, you know, that lives in kind of direct opposition to the actual mechanisms that are taking place within that work that he's doing.
The story gets really complicated when we come to know Khalifa al-Akili. Just explain who he is first, because then I want to work through his part in all of this. He's one of the POIs, the persons of interest that Saeed is... has been told to follow to learn about.
Yeah, Khalifa al-Akili is a 34, 35-year-old white Muslim convert. He grew up in Pittsburgh as a Protestant, I believe. And yeah. I think sometime in his teenage years, he was arrested for possession of drugs and for selling drugs. And I've heard different things from him that whether he converted to Islam while he was in jail or, you know, beforehand. But at some point he began, you know, identifying as a Muslim and began practicing the faith, and in a very kind of open way, you know, wearing kind of short pants and believing in very kind of strict and conservative tenets of, you know, ideology and expressing affections for the Taliban and for that school of ideology that they were based in. And I think that he began posting about this and was very vocal about his views and about his kind of affinity for the Taliban that, you know, kind of put him on the FBI's radar, as it should. You know, someone who's kind of openly expressing, respect and admiration for the Taliban, as well as referring to Osama bin Laden as Sheikh bin Laden.
Right.
You know, and then there's lots of kind of dialogues within his Facebook page between, you know, saying that the FBI or the U.S. government has concocted this. Osama bin Laden is not responsible for what took place. And so I think I don't think he would say, I admire this man for killing thousands of people, but I think he plays both sides of the fence. Like, I respect him if he did, but he didn't. So Sheikh bin Laden. He's kind of a very,
right.
He's a very problematic individual.
But this is the question, though, that makes this I think this is the story that makes the question of what is entrapment and what isn't so critical here. Because, you know, Khalifa, as you mentioned, you know, Saeed calls him a thug. He mentions, you know, he seems like he's a petty criminal to Saeed. But then, we see these images in the film of Khalifa holding a sword where he writes, "Allah grant me the death of a martyr," calls himself a soldier of Islam. And there are all these books on this page that are anti-Semitic, has this personal library with books of... I mean, as you said, the FBI would be interested in a person like that. But the question then is what he was doing illegal Isn't that the critical question? At what point does it cross the line? And at what point do you want an organization like the FBI targeting someone like that? Because if you look at the trajectory of their life, it would be, on some level, kind of a reasonable expectation to say, this guy could be a terrorist eventually.
Yeah, I mean, Khalifa is a totally legitimate target of investigation. And once upon a time, like, that's what the FBI did. They investigated. And, you know, the way that a lot of these investigations begin, they call out an informant, someone like Saeed, to make what they call as an assessment. You know, we're going to give you a few months. We want you to, you know, talk to him, get close to him, you know, try to feather in some conversations about jihad or, you know, extreme, you know, what's taking place, whether violence is justified. And based on the results of that assessment, then we'll determine whether or not we proceed. And right. Here at this point, we've returned to the central issue here is that when you're bringing out people with a criminal history and offering them money and saying, you have money for the next 3 months,
right?
You know, and maybe if this guy's a threat, then that money will continue. So you are effectively, if you're the result of your assessment is this person is not a threat, then that cash flow is cut off, you know, and that they know that, everyone knows that. And so there's such incentive for these people to lie and to kind of magnify, you know, the threat here that the whole system is, you know, it's fraught with issues like this. This is the kind of the critical central point that we want people to consider is that, How are we to really truly assess what threats exist if these are the people making those assessments? It's not trained agents, you know, who are kind of like having these conversations. Yeah. And that's something that Saeed says. I have not received any training. You know, he's worked for the FBI for nearly 20 years.
Yeah.
And there's been no training whatsoever. And I think once they kind of introduce these rules, then they know those rules can be broken and they can later be accused of breaking them. So they just say, I think it's best, let's avoid the conversation entirely. And within the case of Khalifa, Saeed was not the first informant to approach him. Khalifa had been approached by informants for several years.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, we're talking about a field office, an FBI field office in Pittsburgh. You know, it's much like many field offices across the country where there's not a lot going on. You know, there's small Muslim communities and maybe there's a handful of people who kind of stand out in those communities. And Saeed had said, like, if Khalifa was in New York, they wouldn't notice him. He wouldn't land on the radar because, you know, there's a dozen people. There's dozens of people like him, people who are like scary looking and doing and saying, you know, not doing anything, but actually saying things that are offensive and problematic.
Outspoken, kind of brash.
Outspoken.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're puffing out their chest. And that's a lot of these people are converts, people who are looking to kind of express their newfound place within this religion. You know, I'm coming to this religion and I'm a strong believer and I express that kind of my connection to this religion by making statements such as this. But in Pittsburgh, you know, he's a big fish and let's get him. And they spent 6-7 years trying to get him. And this like what we happened to capture was the tail end of that, of those efforts. And Saeed said, you know, they can't spend this much money and this much time on someone and then just walk away.
Right.
You know, they need to follow through. They need to make an arrest.
Well, of course, Khalifa, as we learn in the film, he starts posting on Facebook that he's on to the FBI. He knows that he's being followed. He absolutely understands what's going on. And it makes him nervous because he's worried that, you know, and this is why he starts to be very public. He doesn't want to get arrested. He doesn't want the things that he said, which I'm sure he recognizes inflammatory, to get him arrested. So he starts being really public. And this is when you find him. And this is, I have to say, when your jaw really does drop in the film, when you realize that you start following Khalifa around. Khalifa doesn't know you're following Saeed around. Saeed doesn't know you're following Khalifa around. That must have been, I don't know, not just hard to keep that to yourself, but that must have been dicey, difficult. Not ethically, but it must have been hard to manage all of that.
No, I think there is an ethical question here. Unfortunately, we've been advised right from, you know, from the start by the ACLU and other legal advisors, like if you cannot tell either men about the other. You could then be accused of tampering with an investigation. You are just there to document. And that, you know, we'd known about Khalifa for months. You know, of course we wanted to talk to him. We were dying to talk to him. But we knew that if we approached him, you know, that could put us in a very vulnerable position or we could be accused of tampering and potentially be sent to prison. And that is something we wanted to avoid. Right. However, Khalifa put the pieces together and began posting online those suspicions, and immediately we reached out and we said, you know, we're journalists who are interested in these issues. Let's talk. And he was, you know, he that's what he was looking for. He wanted documentation of what was taking place. But again, our legal advisor said, do not tell him about your relationship with Saeed, because that could also upset the relationship. So, but at the same time, you can sense that the end is coming near. They'd issued a subpoena for a friend of his regarding a photograph that he had taken of Khalifa at a shooting range. And it seemed like something was in motion to kind of separate Khalifa from his wife and daughter. And he was fearful, and we felt kind of this an extraordinary burden, and wondering is there material, is there information that we possess that could potentially reverse this process, reverse this, you know, this machine from grinding him up and, you know, arresting him. But unfortunately, the FBI arrested Khalifa on a gun charge, yeah. And there was a photograph they had of him at a shooting range, and unfortunately, Khalifa did not realize that it just, you know, holding a gun and going to a shooting range was a violation of his parole. He knew that, you know, he wasn't allowed to possess a handgun. He didn't realize possession meant just holding and touching, you know, and he's spoken to, you know, many other inmates while he's been inside. And many people say, I had no idea either. And his public defender said, I've handled thousands of gun cases over my career, and I've never once seen a case where the government prosecuted someone based on a photograph of them at a shooting range. You know, yes, people on their way to, you know, carry out a robbery, or they get caught with it walking down the street or in their car, you know, where it's actually in their owner, it's on their person, it's in their car, it's in their home. But never has she ever seen a case like this. And it's a desperate move by a desperate, you know, group of agents who need to kind of show results. And this is the result. We got him. He's in prison. It may not be what we wanted him for, but we got him.
Yeah,
and we'll take it from now.
He's in prison, and one part of the story is, of course, that he contacts this group called the Project Salaam, and because he knows, he also feels, you know, the hot breath on his neck. He knows something's coming down. He's trying to avoid being arrested, trying to protect his family, and Project Salaam plans this press conference. In just a few days hence, he's going to be part of this to go even more public than he has. And there's this moment from the film I want to play where Khalifa he's in an elevator leaving his attorney because he's saying, what do I do? I don't want to get arrested. You capture this moment in the film. Here's another clip from Terror.
They obviously don't really have anything on me, and so they're are still trying, but you never know, you know. Just you never know. As far as I know, I mean, Allah knows best, but I haven't seen anyone following me today. Why do we have to live in fear? Why does my family have to live in fear every day now? Whenever I walk out, my wife's wondering, you know, is her husband going to return? You know, I have a 9-month-old baby, and my wife now, like, she don't have no family in this country at all. So if something happens to me, you know, where does that leave my family?
That's from the film Terror, co-directed by David Felix Sutcliffe, who joined us last year to talk about it. This coming Tuesday at 11 o'clock, it's airing on KUED Channel 7. It's part of the PBS series Independent Lens. For more showtimes and information, just go to our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the filmmaker David Felix Sutcliffe. He co-directed the film Terror, about the controversial tactics used by the U.S. government in the wake of 9/11. Terror is screening next week on PBS, and we'll give you details about that as we go along. Let's come back, David Felix Sutcliffe, to the the idea of Saeed Torres as a tragic figure, because I think that's right. All of this has left, I mean, he's a man, there's a really poignant moment in the film when he talks about his struggle with his faith. And it's sad because he's been involved so deeply in his Muslim community, helping people. I think one of the most powerful lines he says is he's so adamant about saying, I was an asset to the community and I loved it. And now he's been disconnected from his community. He's been disconnected really in many ways from his faith. That's almost as tragic as anything in the film, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, that he joined the Panthers, you know, not only because their ideas spoke to him, but because it was a fraternity of brothers, people that he felt at home with. And in many ways, that's been something that I've seen, like in kind of talking to him, is that he often is looking for a fraternity. He's looking for a community of people. He's a very social person. He likes to kind of charm, and he likes to kind of be enjoyed and enjoy others. And unfortunately, when the arrest of Tariq Shah took place and he testified in the trial of Tariq Shah's co-defendant, you know, everyone from the community came out. Everyone came and they saw him up there on the stand. And there'd been talk beforehand, but people said, no, Saeed, an informant? No, that's not possible. And then they saw him, and they saw him speak, and they found out that, yes, it was absolutely true. And that's when he had to flee New York. That's when he disappeared, you know, and that, you know, that he'd grown up in New York and, you know, spent so much time there building those relationships and being a part of that community. And now he can't go back. You know, he cannot go back. He's terrified that he'll see people, that they'll see him, that, you know, that there, you know, what, you know, he wants to avoid it. He wants to explain it. He, you know, it's this kind of mess. And I think part of his motivation making the film is to kind of explain himself. You know, he's not going to apologize, but right. I think he wants his story to be told. I think he wants them to listen. And also, you know, I think that what really makes it complicated for him is that he wants to kind of, you know, he can't, if he can't be a part of that community, then maybe at least he can be a part of like the FBI. He's part of the team. Mm. But it's so clear that that's not the case. You know, he is expendable. His safety is not a priority. Khalifa posted on Facebook that he was, you know, convinced that he was being set up. He knew that Saeed was an informant. He's posting this on Facebook. The FBI knows that Saeed is not the most social media savvy person. They're aware that the post is going up, but they don't tell him. You know, and fortunately, Khalifa is not capable of violence, or at least is not, didn't attack Saeed, you know, but he could have. And maybe another person, if this person was actually a legitimate threat, they would have gone after Saeed. But that wasn't the case. So, you know, his home, his family, his coworkers, if you want to call them that, the FBI, you know, he belongs nowhere and with no one. And at this point, the only person he really has is his son. And I think that's one of the things that really kind of, you know, is... I have deep respect for that relationship, and yeah. It's the one of the things that kind of salvages my, you know, my own relationship with Saeed. Mm-hmm. That I see how much he cares about his son, and I see that, you know, there is the capacity for caring, you know, and that he does love this person and will do what he can to protect them. But at the same time, you know, the choices that he's made up until this point have fractured and disconnected him from every other person in his life.
Let me play one more moment from the film. This is the voice of Marlene Jenkins. This is Tariq Shah's mother, and she's featured at moments in the film. Nothing to say really to set this up. I think it's self-explanatory. Here it is from the film Terror.
I guess I should really, really hate him. But you know why I don't? Because... the old folks say, what you reap, you will sow. And with all that he's done to my family and somebody else's family, he may be physically out of jail, but mentally he's not. So I don't think that I would want to be in his place right now.
David Felix Sutcliffe, do you know where Saeed is? These days, has he seen the film? How is he reacting?
He's in an undisclosed location, but he has seen the film, and he actually gave it 4.5 stars out of 5.
Is that right?
he likes the film, and when we asked him, you know,
that
what's
surprises
the missing
me that he likes it, because it shows him in such a vulnerable light. That's interesting.
Well, I think part of it is that, you know, that inability to see himself. So he is seeing a different film than we are. And I think, but when we asked him what is the reason for that missing half star, he said, well, I'm miserable. I don't like seeing myself so sad. I don't like that's who I am and that's where I am. But that's the story. And he knows that better than we do.
Does Lyric check in with him from time to time?
Yeah, Lyric and I both, you know, Lyric talks to him much more regularly than I do, but you know, I also talk to him, and I talk to Khalifa much more frequently. I talk to Khalifa every week, every other week or so.
And who's Khalifa's serving an eight-year sentence, right, still?
He's serving an eight-year sentence. His wife, you know, the day that Khalifa was arrested, the government evicted his wife and child from public housing, and she spent the next several months kind of scrambling around trying to find shelter. And also, at a certain point, the government just said, listen, we want you out of the country. It's what they call a voluntary deportation.
Right.
And so she fortunately has family in the UK. She was born in Somalia, but she grew up in the UK. So she's back there now, but she doesn't know if she'll be able to return. That, you know, Khalifa was on, you know, he spoke with a radio producer at Democracy Now. We did an interview for that several months ago. After that interview, the prison kind of penalized him and said, you know, we didn't want you to do that interview, and we're going to suspend your phone privileges for the next 6 months. So he can't talk to his family for the next 6 months. He's disconnected. He doesn't know what's going to happen, or, you know, whether his family will still be whole, you know, whether he'll be able to rejoin them when he comes out. And, you know, he's pursuing a criminal a civil lawsuit against the FBI for harassment. So hopefully there will be at least some good news to report, you know, and down the line on that front.
Yeah. David Felix Sutcliffe. He co-directed and co-produced the documentary film Terror alongside filmmaker Lyric Cabral. He joined us last summer. The film is airing this coming Tuesday night on KUED Channel 7. It's part of the PBS series Independent Lens. There are details about it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.